brought my little life cycle chart along with to give you some idea of the cycle within which families go through in American culture, at least. The very colors of the pie point out the phases of the cycle through which the average family moves through. The married pair, called this sometimes the honeymoon phase or stage of marriage, is the most precarious, it's the most dangerous, the most anxious because of the adjustments people have to make. The highest percentages of divorces that occur in marriage occur usually in this first cycle, showing that this is certainly a fertile, anxious time of life. And one reason why we've been experimenting and exploring preparation for marriage series based on functional type of things rather than purely academic in our own medical center for the past 7 years, and where I've sort of taken my stand. I think you have to sort of take your stand somewhere in terms of where you're going to try to work with the suffering of the world, and this is the area right from here that I feel most comfortable with, the young adults who are moving into marriage. Then, of course, the various phases move along, and the phase we'll be interested in primarily will be this phase called the adolescent school years. The family, marriage, parents, the whole family unit has confined itself to the pressure, the tension, the anxiety, the life, the dynamics of the involvement in that particular phase. But I think it's an important sort of cycle showing us that the family life is not steady, it's dynamic. The life in which you and I live our family, the family in which we live our life, rather, move in a sort of a swirl. And life changes according to the pressures and the limits of the responsibility. First child, crowded year, the 30 school year, the adolescent year, the child option year, the empty nest year, of course, the aging year. I use this a lot with the young adults to point out to them the relevancy and importance of recognizing that they may look at their coming married with the stars in their eyes and a lot of moon glow, but to recognize there will be a lot of shifts, a lot of movement, a lot of growth, and a lot of different concepts in the dynamic movement of the family. I want you to keep that in mind as we talk a little bit today about adolescence and family. It's sort of a hard day to be a Christian, I think, but then it's always been a hard day to be a Christian. Never has been an easy time in culture. You hear a lot of pessimistic individuals who say, well, this is the worst time of all. Anybody who raises boys and girls today certainly are, it's a terrible era within which to raise children. Get married but don't have kids. I hear this once in a while, and I tell them, well, I think that you're sort of a die-hard pessimist. I think that you look at life through rather pessimistic eyes, and I think that probably we have a great deal of marvelous things to our advantage today to raise families, and we ought to be reasonably optimistic about the future and reasonably optimistic about our life in the present tense. Tacitus, the Roman writer, said at one point in history that we are entering into a period rich with wars, torn with sedition, savage in its very hours of peace. And he was speaking of the world into which the Christian church was born. You and I might say, well, this sounds very much like our world today, and I think it does. We are told today that we are living in a post-Christian era. But pray tell, when do we ever go through the Christian era? When has any era really been Christianized, in a sense, what we think of it in the church, being committed to God and living its life relevant, not tangent, but relevant and within the dimensions of in with and under the totality of Christ's involvement in the world. The problems that the church faces, I think, today are the problems it has always faced. Certainly, the magnitude is greater. We are living under some rapidly changing concepts. In the year 1700, we are told the world's knowledge doubled over what it had in year zero. By 1900, the world's knowledge again doubled over what it knew in the year 1700. By 1950, it again doubled. By 1956, it again doubled. By 60, 62. And now, with the use of IBM computers, we sort of can compute the fact that the world's knowledge probably will double at the rate of every 2 years. And, you know, what's happening to the pressures that we all live under with the shifting weight of cultural change, the shifting weight of the world's knowledge moving in on us on all sides. Certainly one of the factors causing some of the real concern we have about adolescence is the force, the forces in our time that are probably unique. Some of the things in the family itself, for example, we see marriage as primarily person-oriented, no longer family-oriented. At one time in culture, people were concerned about establishing a family. This was the basic reason for which you married and you lived together. But today, it seems that adolescents and young people think primarily in terms of person-oriented. They want to establish a companionship to go through life together. Divorce has become accepted as a solution to marital disharmony, and we accept it with some degree of openness, realizing that even in church we feel that it does not carry quite the stigma it carried at one time. Physical sex, of course, has been distorted. I think we're aware of this. I don't think as much as some people think it has. I think the problem of immorality is as great, nationally speaking, as we read sometimes in these exciting magazine articles that tell us all about how bad the world is getting and how bad sexual life is getting. I think you have to keep in mind a lot of magazine writers who have to earn their salt, and because of this, they've got to find some very exciting things to write about. And the more pitch they can give to their articles, the more they're going to sell. I'm totally convinced, after looking at this for some time, that we don't have quite the problem of sexual looseness and liberty, nationally speaking, that we sometimes hear about. But physical sex has and is being distorted. Madison Avenue expectations in Hollywood, Broadway plays, our culture is certainly being influenced highly by the seductiveness of sexuality. If you're going to sell lawnmowers, if you're a manufacturer of lawnmowers, and you want to sell lawnmowers, you want to take a photograph of a little creature pushing a lawnmower down this green grass. Of a seductive, perfectitudinous blonde, probably has the right proportions, and this will sell your lawnmower. So, we use sex, of course, a great deal to sell many things in our culture. The drive towards sexual equality has confused the roles between men and women. And we really see this. What is masculinity and what is femininity? The confusion of the ambiguity of roles in marriage is a very real one. Those of us who are involved in marriage counseling, and I do quite a bit of this, I have as a fundamental problem to ascertain with this couple as to whether or not you're really masculine. What does it mean to be a male? You ever stop to think about that? What does it mean to be a female? What does it mean to play a feminine role in marriage? Well, certainly the masculine and feminine role in marriage is highly changed by the rapid cultural change around us. At one time it was quite easy to discern, well, a man did this and this, and the woman did this and this, and so on. Today we have women who are pursuing masculine, quotes, type occupations, and we have men who are pursuing feminine type occupations. And the word masculinity, femininity, these concepts are rapidly changing concepts for all of us. We see in the family children's rights emphasized, not their duties or obligations or responsibilities, but their rights. Talk very much about responsibility. And I think that this is certainly a problem that enters into the family as we know it. Laws and customs have lengthened childhood dependency to include the years of high school and increasingly the years of college. And parents work sometimes to lavish upon their children numerous things and maternal advantages. One of the real problems of parents is that they absolutely want to give their kids things they just never had. And they, I think, are bending over backwards to give them these things. We see the family as a cash-requiring consumer unit. The family used to be a unit of production. Boys and girls were economic necessity. Today they are economic liabilities, economically speaking. And families no longer are units of production, but units of consumption. And the American family especially is a highly consuming unit. It has a greater yearning power than its earning power, and as a result, it has all kinds of pressures that are imposed upon itself because it just can't do enough. Mobility is widespread. You know, 2 out of 10 families are moving every year. You can expect in your own neighborhood that about 2 out of 10 neighbors will pull up roots, call in a moving van and move somewhere to California or to Minnesota or the East Coast or South or wherever it may be. And we are indeed a nation on wheels. In my own neighborhood, I think one family that lived one place 1 year, one place the next year, in our neighborhood the next year, and moved on the following year. And you think of the anxiety that may create in a family. I think it raises some real anxiety. At least years ago, when boys and girls were raised in a family that was not very close and very secure, at least it had the continuity of its own environment to give some stability to its structure. The neighborhood stayed about the same. The trees were there, the hills were there, the same families, the same people, and so on. It had some continuity of environment. But today, with the environment changing and highly in flux, and a family changing in flux, you can see what kind of pressure that may bring on the fact that the family is constantly moving, and boys and girls grow up having some real wrestle and some real struggle with themselves as persons. Well, I might go on and talk about a lot of things. There are many other things to talk about, but let me move into a different phase here of family life for a moment. And that is that our culture is used to be called the space age, atomic age and space age, the electric age. The newest symbol, my friends, is cybernetics. We are a cybernetic culture. We are a culture that's going to live with computers, and we're going to be influenced by a technological, electric, computer kind of life, and this is going to change and I think give some problems to all of us. We see man, because of this, becoming more and more impersonalized. Values and religion are being diluted. Passive men, aggressive women, the loss of honor, pledge, esteem, integrity are factors which are plaguing all of us. Religion becoming secularized. The thing that disturbs, I think, a lot of us is that people are becoming impersonalized. They are, I'm talking about giving everybody who's born a number, you know, you have that number, that's your life, driver's license number, your automobile number, your marriage number. It's the number you go through all the way through life, like in the service, you have a service number, and you don't even know your own name anymore because you're just a service number. This concept of impersonalizing people is going to, I think, present some very real problems, as it has already. Man is beginning to feel that he is neither a pilgrim nor a tourist, but he is a wanderer on this thing called Earth in space and time. And there is a weakening of family structure. Families are becoming more brittle. They are people and families are beginning to talk at each other and not with each other. I think one exciting old movie says something like this: "Have I told you lately that I loved you?" There are many families who haven't told each other that they love each other. They sort of talk at, but never talk with each other. We're living in a culture too of fun morality. Happiness is the biggest business of our time. Great business. Important to be happy. Very important to be happy. We even have ouchless bandages you can buy to give your kids when they get a sore or a scratch so that they don't have any ouch and hurt. And we don't want our kids to sort of have the trauma and face the anxieties that we'd like to exclude them from some of this. I think this is a real serious problem in our culture. Dr. Frost, I think, mentioned yesterday the great need of American people to know what suffering is. I've been sort of thinking this way for a long time, working in a medical center with disturbed people. I think we are a people who don't know what sacrifice means, or we don't want to sacrifice. We truly want our cake and eat it too. I can think of a young couple I counseled this spring who went through our marriage counseling course. A pair of you who were moving into a $23,000 house. They're both just out of college. They have all their furniture bought, and they have a grand piano. And they have two new cars, one's a convertible, and they're both 22 years old. Well, it's important to be happy, and it's important to have these things which are essential to life. We have, as a nation, become intoxicated with materialism. We're drunk. with gadgets. We have lots of nice precious junk in our homes. Pretty important thing. We are, of course, mesmerized by technological advances. Science and technology have done a great deal to improve our life and living. Scientists tell us that they have so many new things still lying in their drawers, they don't dare to bring them out, because man can't possibly move emotionally, spiritually, psychologically to measure up to the developments of our time. While we are moving technologically, scientifically, in unique and marvelous ways, and I'm for it, I love the things we see, man himself, emotionally, spiritually, can't make the progress at the same rate that science and technology makes. So we have a greater kind of a cultural lag in terms of this also. Well, these are some problems that we see in our world around us. Throughout history, the family has served four basic functions of life: to legitimize sexual relationships and establish legal parenthood, to nourish infants and train them as children for adulthood, to establish division of labor between men and women so that men and women have a distinct division of labor, and the division is clear between themselves, maybe kind of foggy between others, but clear between themselves, and it's acceptable to themselves. And for families, link in-laws in a wider group of relatives, we talk about kinfolk, on whom a man or a woman could rely and could rely on in terms of crises. One of the problems we see here in our culture is that we are called nuclear families. We don't need our kinfolk any longer. As long as we've got government, we've got good medical educational programs, we've got good neighborhoods, plenty of affluence, we don't have to see our Uncle Louie up in northern Alaska for a while, nor rely on him at all. We are nuclear families. Tend to exist as parents and children only, with no room for single adults who are unmarried, no room for grandparents, no room for anybody else. So shall just call us the nuclear family, only parents and children. Well, today's family has taken on a new shape, has taken on a new shape rather rapidly. And it has certainly created some problems in youth. Dave Roberts, in his exciting little book, Psychotherapy and Christian View of Man, says everything good and everything bad in us starts in the family. Everything good and everything bad starts in the family. I think it's true. Family is still, as it has always been, the basic unit within which we establish and build and understand intuitively, academically, spiritually, what life is about. It's the unit within which we establish our own personal life system, our own personal identity. The family is certainly a very important unit of life. What distresses me, and I suppose because I tend to look at many things through the eyes of psychology and sociology, is how few pastors care about the family. I wonder how many of you men who are pastors have preached on the family during the last 2 years. When you host symposiums on families, you get very few people interested in the family because somehow it doesn't carry with it the extent. You talk about the dynamics of marriage, it doesn't come out because that's kind of interesting to think about the role of marriage and its problems and their pressure. But the family itself as a unit, I think, is a very important factor in our work with people because everything good and everything bad starts with the family. And we are within ourselves a child. Dr. Hume said this today, before, we are the adult, the parent, and we are also ourselves, the ego. Stabilizing the attitudes, defeating the problems, the misconceptions, the lack of identity, the distortions of life and value that we have established as a child in the family, and now the responsibilities I feel in my own life as an adult, as a person, and I must somehow reconcile the fact that I had problems, and when I was 3 years old, my mother dropped me on my head, and I fell sideways and didn't ever straighten out, versus the fact that I must now, in this life, be a responsible person to walk on my own 2 feet and to somehow marshal all the resources and forces in my life to be a person who can produce and to be a individual who owns himself. Well, you see, we get into a lot of these dynamics when you're dealing with the pressures and problems of family. The family feeds each person or stifles the energy and the freedom of each person to become a true person. It's true that we either establish a sense of an awareness and awakening of our own true self as we grow up in our homes, or we are stifled by this. Some physicians think that every child is born with an equal amount of potential psychic energy. Freud thought so. The reason that most of us end up having a great difference in terms of psychic emotional functional energy is that something has happened along the process of growth and development to thwart, to repress, to destroy, to plow under some of the potential that we have. We know that academically and emotionally too, when we are expending ourselves at our greatest, we still are only using 5% or so of our potential. We still have a tremendous amount of reserve left, there is therefore no real relationship between the intellectual ability people have and the emotional concept of being secure and stable and believing in oneself, which is why we have overachievers and underachievers in school, and why we have, I think, people who are reasonably secure mentally speaking and people who are in prison emotionally, unable to function, yet they have marvelous IQs. Well, what about young people, adolescents? The young are always problematic. They're always sort of concerned with the daydreams and conversion experiences, impoverished idealism. They're embarrassed, they're sort of awkward. They have gigantic appetites, these adolescents have. Improvement prowlers, they have always rebelled against mother and father, and they seem to have passionate crushes. And these abnormalities are really normal in growing up. And it's not only what we mean when we talk about youth problems, youth have problems. These are relatively par for the course for adolescents. Youth problems develop when modern society fails to provide a world for the young to take part in as they grow up. And when they fail to help adolescents develop a sense of identity and a sense of intimacy. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in a few minutes. Basically, I think the parents are pretty busy sabotaging the whole concept, the whole world of adolescence. Because it's in this phase here that parents say they have the least amount of satisfaction as members of the family. One research I ran into said something like this, that during the adolescence of their children, the family finds that it is a time of lesser love in terms of the wife. Wife feels during this time, first of all, that she's less loved by her children, less loved by her husband, and she starts to putter on the periphery a little bit, and she finds herself working frantically to keep up with all the needs of her family, but finds less reward or less feedback. Now, I'm analyzing the research that Reuben Hill has done on the family of the adolescent. Secondly, it's a time in the family when the lowest satisfaction with marriage is established. It's at the period of the adolescence of children that parents feel less feedback, less worthwhileness in this thing called marriage. They seem to find the pressures of life so great, the pressures of the economic needs so great that their own marital relationship and the own family relationship is less satisfying to father and mother this time. During the adolescence of youth, parents tend to feel that this is the time of the declining male authority in terms of being an authoritative person to his wife or ability to influence the wife, and it's a time also of increased female authority, the decrease of the male in terms of the wife, the influence over the wife, and the time of the increase in the female in terms of her authority with children. Well, this may be true because psychologically, you mean that around the midpoint of life, 35, 40, sort of mellow and slow down a little bit, and women tend to develop more socially, more aggressively. But it may be through other factors, many other factors as well. The period of family life around the adolescent is a time of the greatest economic pressure. Adolescence and late adolescence, the college age, the time when the family economically has the greatest amount of pressure. So you have some true anxieties built into the cycle of a family. Here for a few years, and along with it, parents may be so preoccupied with their own needs, their own concerns, their own anxieties, their own lack of feedback in terms of their own personal gratification in their own family life and marriage that they are ignoring the needs of the youth. They're ignoring the concerns of the youth. It's a time also when mothers seem to say that they know their kids the least, and they seem to feel the least needed by them. When they seem to be unable to communicate to them and haven't reached them at all. And of course, you know, one of the fundamental needs cries of adolescents is that they just can't speak the same language as their parents speak. And it may be that the parents are preoccupied with themselves, life around them, talking at each other and not with each other, and hence they never learn to speak with their own young adults at home. The basic needs, of course, of these adolescents are, according to Eric Erickson, whom I like very much as a child psychologist and read as much as I can, two things: the need of identity and the need for intimacy. Youth's basic needs: to establish a healthy feeling of who I am, where have I come from, where am I going, what am I like as a person, and the need also for intimacy. And parents, I think, are probably so preoccupied, they are sort of sabotaging the young people. They may, as I said, be so busily concerned with their own life together and their own lack of feedback that they are not thinking about the impending growth, the process of the movement of growth in terms of adolescent needs, and hence find themselves growing farther and farther and farther away from youth. And or they may be so concerned with social economic needs that they are dedicated to the pursuit of happiness, and because of this they are not relating as they need to relate to the young people. The Martinson report, which came out in the state of Minnesota last year, suggests that at this time in the family, parents have become very, very permissive. One of the problems with young adults, young adolescents, are acting out sexually, getting involved in terms of unwed fatherhood, unwed motherhood, is that parents are quite permissive. Well, they're sort of trying to find themselves. They sort of have been handed down for so many years to see what the pressures of raising little kids, that they sort of get out from under many responsibilities in terms of parenthood and become quite permissive. Okay, Johnny, you can stay home over the weekend all by yourself. We're going to go to Aunt Sarah's for a couple of days. Be a good girl, don't want anybody else in the house. And of course, this allows Johnny to use his own home and bring his own girlfriend over. Before long, the sexual knowledge come alive, and they liberties they shouldn't be taking. Parents are quite permissive during this period. And there is almost a shocking permissiveness that youth are left at home unchaperoned. Youth are left to go by themselves unchaperoned. And I think, as I understand, adolescents at the time when they really want to be chaperoned. They want not to be hovered over, you know, not to be smothered, but they like to know that there is always someone there who they can ask questions of and to feel the security of a stable hand. And I think to be with great permissiveness is something which they really don't want. They want freedom, yes. They want freedom to be persons to make decisions on their own, but they need the security of a stable person or a stable people who are nearby just to feel that everything is in order. Well, as I've intimated before, probably the basic, most fundamental anxiety in parents is that they, at least they say to me, that, you know, how can you stand to have three adolescent daughters? Oh, I can't stand my kids. I've got a 15-year-old boy or a 15-year-old girl, and I just can't talk to them. I just can't talk to her. And I tell them, well, you know, I'm finding adolescence in our family is one of the most exciting phases of our family life. We have a lot of fun together. We do things together, we talk together, we play together, we have a great deal of fun. We communicate as adults. For the first time, I'm not talking baby talk, you know, I'm talking the kind of language I want to speak with them. And we have a lot of growth, a lot of movement. And I think that most parents feel that the era or the phase of the greatest anxiety in their own family life comes at this phase of their own family existence. Of having adolescents around, because adolescents somehow do not speak the same language the parents do. Well, there's always been a gap between generations. Every culture, I think, has had it. But this culture, moving so rapidly, moving much more rapidly, in this era, moving much more rapidly than ever before, is, I think, creating a greater gap between the generation of adults and the generation of adolescents. And because of this, I think we have to be far more flexible with adults, far more adaptive, far more capable of living open-ended lives, so we are growing all the time and moving in the same area that our kids are. Parents can, I think, speak the same language as adolescents. But kids say, well, they don't. Parents always say the wrong thing. They give supervision, but we ever have any relationship. That's the big problem. Parents give supervision, but no relationship. I think kids are looking for a relationship. They want to know their father and mother as people. They say things like this, well, you know, my dad and mom, they kind of made it. They've arrived. Older people have sort of arrived. They've grown through this. They've gone to college. They've gone on. So when they made it, you know, they always let us know that when they were adolescents or when they were 10 years old, so-and-so took place. They're always creating the impression, maybe they don't mean to do it, but they create the impression that they've arrived in life, that they've made it, and somehow since we haven't made it yet, you know, they let us know that we are adults, and we made it in life, and you kids are still in process. And somehow they get the attitude that because we've made it, we just don't have any problems any longer. We don't have any anxieties. Yeah. We aren't learning. We aren't growing. We aren't being open. I think kids talk about this quite a bit. And one of the great pressures on them is the fact that they want a relationship with parents and adults, but they seem to feel emotionally the door closed because adults create the attitude that they made it in life. But they don't have to grow, change, develop, modify their own thinking, their own experiences anymore in life. And these kids are still in process of continuous change and continuous modification. And so we need a better code of communication, a better balance of strength and needs, open and honest communication. And probably the most advantageous technique an adult can use in working with adolescents is indeed communication. And this particular gadget for about learning how to listen. Learning how to listen. And not necessarily evaluating every statement, every concept that adolescents throw at us, but learning to listen to how they feel about these things going on in their life. And as we listen to them, as we relate to them, not just supervise them, but also relate to them, we establish identity. Because the impending need of the adolescent is to identify as an adult. He's trying to do this. Two generations ago, when the young girl, the young boy grew up in a rural home or in a small town, at age 12, 14, they were doing an adult's job. A 12-year-old boy could do an adult man's job to help the field. He didn't have to worry about whether he was going to grow up. He knew he was already grown up. He could do it. The 16-year-old gal had to do her housework and had to do these things around the house. She could cook. She could sew. She had some identity already as a woman. She didn't have to ask and wonder who she was. She knew who she was because she already could identify in terms of her own maturity. But pray tell, you know, what is characteristic today of the adolescent boy or the adolescent girl in terms of identity? What can they do? How can they identify with adults who can't get a job at 16? It's hard to get a job at 17 in areas. Good thing. What do they do being 7 months? We tend to postpone adolescence because there are so few opportunities for them to identify with the adult workforce and adult symbols. It's time for no cavalier attitude. There are no magic dragons in finding solutions except to recognize that we have a real fantastic job on our hands, I think, in terms of helping adolescents grow up, relating, identity, intimacy, working with family units to get them communicating with adolescents, and to realize that these young people are increasingly unproductive, and that we have to find a way in which we can help them become productive. They're sort of excluded as partners from our culture, as we also exclude the aged, as we also exclude the small farmers, Negroes, Mexicans, and whatnot, exclude them from the whole cultural fabric, and they have to be a part of it. I think protesting won't be quite so acute if we could understand some of the reasons why they are protesting. Well, we live in a world without real answers. I don't have a lot of answers to a lot of these things. Certainly, lots of shades gray. We are all, in a sense, growing and moving. We are all a part of the fabric of our culture. It's changing rapidly for all of us. So rapidly that we can't possibly understand it in many of its dynamics. But let's think through in terms of what's happening in our own family life, what's happening in the world of the youth, what's happening in our culture, and put these things together to ask ourselves some common sense questions about what we should do and where we should go and how we should minister to them. Well, I think my time is up.